Hey, do you remember Varsity Blues? Hello, and welcome to Hey, Do You Remember?, a show where we reminisce about a movie or TV series we grew up with, then take off the rose-tinted glasses to see how it holds up today. I'm Chris.
I'm Donna.
And I'm Carlos.
And today we're revisiting Varsity Blues. In West Texas, football isn't just a sport, it's a way of life. And for coach Bud Kilmer, losing is not an option. But when his star quarterback is injured, second stringer John Moxon steps up to take his place and, well, actually everything sort of works out just fine. Mox immediately becomes a superstar and very deftly navigates all of the pressures that come with his new title, including the overbearing nature of Coach Kilmer. Mox is the only one on the team willing to stand up for himself, but he's underestimated just how far Kilmer's willing to go in order to win. Donna, what do you remember about Varsity Blues?
Wow. So Varsity Blues came out in 1999, just before I was able to vote. So I felt like I had a pretty good grasp of my own little world at that point. And I remember I did not like football. Now I'm a huge football fan. I did not. I did not care for football in high school. I was very artsy and I thought, football players just will never understand my art.
This is how we know we're in the past.
That's what I used to sound like in my inner monologue. So,
oh, my God.
no, so I didn't see it in the theater. I thought it was something completely not for me. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, you know, a few months later, it would show up on cable, and you betcha I was watching. It's sort of something you just can't look away when Varsity Blues comes on. It's a little bit train wrecky, or I don't know, the Vanderbeek has a certain draw.
And the Vanderbeek, wow.
The Vand. But, yeah, there's a certain draw to this movie that I always, so I ended up watching it, you know, in bits and pieces over the years. And just sort of always thinking, oh, Varsity Blues. Because what else can you think, you know?
Carlos?
This movie is a staple in my family, simply just because everyone saw it in theaters, and it's on TV, or at least it was on TV all the time. And this was kind of Friday Night Lights before Friday Night Lights for us, although way more melodramatic, I think you'll find, than Friday Night Lights. But, you know, we found the movie to be very truthful to what we thought Texas was like when we were growing up in 99. I definitely was, drawn to the charisma of one James Vanderbeek, the Vand. I just liked the chemistry that the cast seemed to have with each other, you know, especially like Scott Kahn, and Paul Walker is kind of an afterthought, but like Billy Bob is great in this. And Vanderbeek and, you know, he plays it really well. And, this was the first exposure to a lot of these actors that I ever had. This is the first movie I ever saw Paul Walker in. Definitely the first movie I ever saw James Vanderbeek in. Scott Kahn, what's her name? Amy Smart. Allie Larder.
Right.
This is the first time I saw a lot of these actors. This is the first John Voight movie I ever saw.
Oh,
in
wow.
Fact.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, he, it's kind of like Joe Pesci with Home Alone.
Yeah. he's always Coach Kilmer.
He's always going to be Coach Kilmer for me. Yeah, I know.
Tour de force.
Gosh. Okay. I mean, I was already nervous about this and listening to you guys talk. Now I'm really nervous about this because especially Carlos, the extra dig about how much, you know, your whole family enjoys it. I'm like, oh, shit. So here's the deal. I had never seen this movie. And what I remember most is that this was a film that was loved by people I hated. Now, I know that's shitty and dismissive, but this came out when I was 17. I was shitty and dismissive. So, let me clarify, I don't just mean jocks or whatever. My high school certainly had cliques, but when I think about like my experience there, I was not in a group. I think 70% of the kids were just there. You know what I mean? Like just this silent majority that didn't really bend one way or the other. I had friends that were jocks. I had friends that played D&D. I had friends that were stoners. It was just all over the place. This is already sounding like the guy that's like, I'm not racist. I have black friends. but so I didn't resent the fact that this was a movie about football players. Like, you know, sure, there were guys on our team that were assholes, but they were just assholes, period. It wasn't because they played football. There were plenty of really nice, really smart, really cool people who played sports in my school. There were definitely adults in my community who took high school football way too seriously, and a lot of the athletes did get special treatment from certain members of the faculty. That wasn't something I took personally or was ever, you know, particularly affected by. I think it's fertile ground for a story, and it would have been nice if this movie was actually interested in some of that stuff rather than just pretending to be. But the point is, so when I say it was loved by people I hated, I just mean the kids that I heard talking about it, quoting it, whatever. They were just not kids I had much in common with or really got along with, and that definitely colored my impression of the film. And you know, like Donna, I also wasn't really into sports when I was in high school. I still liked sports movies. You know, Remember the Titans, Friday Night Lights. These are great movies. And this really is the immature little brother of Friday Night Lights.
Oh, my God, it is.
So much so that I read that that's what they wanted to do, but that MTV couldn't get the rights to the book, and so this happened instead.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty obvious throughout.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And that's the other thing. I knew this was an MTV movie. It looked like an MTV movie, a little more crass and juvenile and superficial. And listen, that's totally fine. There's a place for that. Orange County is an MTV movie that I love. But this one just didn't seem like it was for me. I had no interest in it. And so when Carlos suggested this, I had two thoughts right away. The first was, okay, fair enough. This is probably the only way I'd sit through this, and maybe I had some misconceptions about it. So, you know, there's an opportunity here. And also, it's different from a lot of the stuff we've looked at for the show, and I like that. I think it's the first thing we've watched from the late 90s. And then my second thought was, shit. Like, movies like this are tricky for me. The ones I have zero attachment to, I mean, like, because there's no nostalgia here. I'm taking this all at face value. And I didn't want this to turn into a situation where, like, I don't know, I still feel bad that I think I hurt Donna's feelings a little bit by being so ruthless about Hocus Pocus, you know, when we did that episode. And I didn't want something like that to happen again. But I guess I do think there's a value in these types of episodes where one of us is watching something for the first time, because that's part of what this is about, what was versus what is. So I am really interested to hear how this played for you guys as teenagers, how our perceptions of it might be different, and what, if anything, changed for you with this viewing. But before we get into it, we're going to pause for a minute and take a look at what was going on in the world in 1999.
Welcome back to 1999.
You got to do the 99, your teenage voice. No, actually, don't. You're fine.
Don't do that voice.
Yeah, what a time. And I love that we're doing this year because we were all, I feel like, pretty close. We were 17, 18-ish when this came out, right? Maybe 16?
Yeah. I was 15.
Oh, 15. Wow. I think I had just turned 17 or was just about to turn 17 when this came out.
Yeah. Okay, so we pretty much have, like, very well-formed ideas of what was going on. This was the year that Bill Clinton's impeachment trials began. Sure, this is the thing. I feel like life has changed so much since then, but this was really right before we started voting, I feel like, such an interesting age. So we're impeaching the president for lying about BJs. Woodstock 99 happened.
Oh, that's right.
Wow. We were throwing back to that time of peace and love. And I think there were, like, riots and fires. And
it was a bad scene, yeah. And it was like, one of several attempts to redo Woodstock. And it never... There was, like, yeah, a lot of weird sexual assault stuff going on in the crowd. Like, a lot of stories about that coming out. Yeah, it was a bad, bad scene.
It was quite a bummer. So, in other movies we might have seen that year, The Matrix came out in 1999. American Beauty that year. The first Austin Powers movie, I think the first one, came out that year. Also American Pie and South Park and The Phantom Menace. And I feel like this was a time when we were probably pretty entrenched. We had some maybe spending money. Mm-hmm. I remember very vividly being able to fill up my gas tank for about $12 in my sweet Saturn. And I could drive all over to all kinds of movies. And I could listen to NSYNC and Backstreet Boys on my radio. And... worry about the president getting too many BJs. Like, that's the little...
Were you really concerned about that? I'm really troubled by how much he's getting his dick sucked. I don't think this seems...
I feel like he should have other things to do. Like, it's a pretty big job.
I feel like if the economy is in a surplus, the president should just get all the BJs he wants.
I mean, I suppose.
Or she wants.
Very fair.
But Donna, you're right. This is the first thing we've looked at where we were not... This is, like, not a lot of home video. We're going to the theaters with our parents. This was our money that we were earning and spending.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, we had, like, our own like, sort of little world at this point.
Absolutely. And you could... You chose your own music and you went and you bought the CDs you wanted. Maybe Kid Rock. Okay. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe
so
Enrique
much.
Iglesias. I'm not sure what you liked. Mariah Carey was... But she's always around, you know.
You totally threw out Kid Rock because you owned the Kid Rock album.
Maybe you just really liked Kid Rock. I don't know. He's, you know, Ba with the Ba is all I'm saying. I feel like that speaks for itself. You know? Sue me. Blink-182. You like that?
Oh, yeah. I owned Enema of the State.
It's a fine album, you know? Things were...
Does no one remember... Okay, right before... That was the album that obviously, like, really blew up. That's the one that kind of made them. But the album before was the one that had the single Damn It on it. And that was...
Huh.
It had... Do you remember, like, So I Guess This Is Growing Up? Does anyone remember that?
That kind of sounds like all of their songs.
No, but keep singing it.
That's still one of my favorite songs of theirs. I never really forget it. I was gonna say, like, I never really got into the next album as much, but then I'm just gonna sound like the guy that's like, I liked them before they were famous. I was never a huge fan, so I'll just leave.
I loved Enema of the State. I still own a copy of Enema of the State, and it's the only album I have that I can listen to the entire thing in like 20 minutes.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that was sort of.
All of their songs are like 2 minutes long.
Yeah. I remember there was the one slower song on that CD. Oh, shoot. Somebody's going to have to.
Adam's song?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. I remember one day at the end of the senior year of high school, end of the day, when I found out that the girl I was dating at the time was cheating on me.
Oh, God.
And, like, we had just had this terrible, terrible fight about something unrelated. And then, like, I thought that was resolved. And so then she goes into her last class. And I was a senior, so I was done a period before her. So I was waiting around to give her a ride home. And one of her friends walks by, and she's like, are you guys okay? Is everything fine? I'm like, yeah, we're fine now. Like, that's – yeah, I had this misunderstanding about whatever, whatever. And she goes, oh, because I thought you were mad about – so-and-so, like some guy's name. And I was like, who the fuck is that? And then I just got to chew on that for like 30 minutes waiting for her class to be over. So then she walks out, this big smile on her face because we're, you know, everything's good again. And I said, who's so-and-so? And it was just a first name. It wasn't even a full name. And the way her face dropped told me everything I needed to know. And so I just walked away from her. And, it was like the first time something like that had happened to me. And I got in my car and that was the song on the radio.
Of course.
And I'm driving home bawling my eyes out to Blink 182.
I die alone.
Oh no.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
Oh, what serious times, you know?
I just had all the feelings when I was
You just tend to, yeah. There are just so many feelings.
I don't want
there.
Your life. There's just
I
so many
don't
feelings.
Want your life.
Things change, Mox.
Oh, my word. And yeah, in the midst of it, Varsity Blues comes out. How about that, you know? Oh, I was also going to tell you that in 1999... MySpace first came to the intranet.
Holy shit.
Really?
I wasn't also aware of that till like 2004.
I know. We were just too young for, I think, you know, these things sort of start college-y, I don't know, but
1999.
And also Napster that year. Napster came out.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Release. I remember the very first song I ever downloaded on Napster.
Oh, please tell us what it is.
A Perfect Circle, Judith.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't know that one.
Okay, all right. Mine would have been like Mambo Number 5.
Yeah, I think mine was like Bailamos. Mm-hmm.
Oh shit! I do not feel bad about the Blink-182 thing. What if that had been on the radio when I got in the car? Bailamos, oh god, let the rhythm take me over.
Te quiero, amor mío.
We will dance no more.
Oh, no. Oh, poor young Chris. Well, yeah, 1999. What a year. Am I right?
I should say that whenever we're considering what movies to do next, in my head, the cutoff is always going to be 15 years ago. Whatever was 15 years ago or before that, to me, is like fair game.
Varsity Blues just made the cut then.
Right.
Like, I mean, we're talking a few days ago. It became 15 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah, so it was like Varsity Blues. I feel like that's from around that era. I thought it was actually earlier. I didn't remember, I couldn't remember if it was like, did I see this in seventh grade or junior year?
Like, there's Jesus. A big,
that's a hell of a window.
I went to the movies all the time. Like, if you asked me, like, what year did, like, Rush Hour come out? I would say somewhere between seventh grade and junior year.
97, I think.
Okay, so eighth grade for me.
Yeah. So, yeah, now that we know what was going on, some context for what was happening that year, let's take another look at Varsity Blues and see how it holds up. You know what's funny is, so you know how on the DVD covers they'll include enthusiastic quotes from critics?
Yeah.
So on the cover of Varsity Blues, this is the quote. Dawson's Creek hunk James Vanderbeek leads this funny coming-of-age story. Now, it's attributed to The Sun, but what I like is that it's just a fact about the film. It might as well say, like, this is definitely a movie starring some actors. It's
just a movie featuring football.
And it cracks me. It's like when they used to put on, like when DVDs were still kind of a new thing, when, like, you know, you would turn it over and bonus features. Before it was standard to have like 2 hours of bonus crap, you just get like, you know, special features, interactive menu. What? Is that not the definition of a menu? What am I?
And like,
what would I do
the special features? The special features would also be like whatever the aspect ratio of your TV was.
Yeah.
Supposed to be like widescreen.
Special features, sound. What a treat. Okay,
you guys, so, can I ask really quick? What was the first DVD you ever bought?
I know the first DVD I ever watched was Gladiator.
That's the first one I bought.
Interesting.
Oh.
Right after I got, my first DVD player. That was my first DVD.
Wow.
The first DVD I ever purchased was Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Batman.
Ooh.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah, I went back to 1989 for both of those.
Obviously, I'm okay with that.
Well, mine was Coyote Ugly.
Oh, my gosh.
Do we serve water in this bar?
I don't think so.
That's not the lie. Yeah. That would be so, not as effective a trailer moment. I don't think so.
I'll have to check with the supervisor.
Let me get back to you. Hold on.
Yeah. Oh, it's a classic.
What I was really struck by was how incredibly earnest the opening of the movie is, considering how dramatically and drastically the tone's going to shift, like, immediately after the title comes on the screen. Because it's all, like, Norman Rockwell, corn-fed Americana stuff. And it's good. It's effective. And Vanderbeek's voiceover is all about how important football is here. But if you remove the football references, this could be the opening of, like, Saving Private Ryan. It's ridiculous. Like, the slow swell of horns and the American flag, and it's all very, very dramatic. But then we see Mox, senior in high school, second string quarterback, more interested in his academics than in playing ball. And we also meet his little brother. And listen, the payoff to this running joke is one of the best moments in the film. But
I was
a little disappointed that, like, this is one of the first things you see. And I really thought they were going somewhere with this, like, this sense of humor was going to be sharper and edgier than I was expecting. And the one-line synopsis of the movie sounded really promising, which we'll get into in a second here. And I guess I was disappointed when I realized I was probably expecting too much from this. Like I said, like, I like the running joke. And on my list of problems with this film, this doesn't even really register. But at this point, it almost made it seem like maybe the opening credits and the overwrought narration were intentional and maybe sort of satirical. And I was optimistic that I was in the hands of a better filmmaker. And then I remembered this is the guy who made Good Burger. So, this scene ends with the little brother, like, he makes a comment about Lance, the star quarterback, getting injured, and Mox going, like, don't you even joke about that. And as someone who's never seen this movie before, I was like, oh, so Lance is getting injured. So that's going to happen.
Yeah.
We should probably say, wait, what the joke was.
I'm so sorry. The little brother's, like, crucified himself.
With string.
He's very spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, exactly. Walking around, like, with this cross. And it's a kind of a running joke through the movie. Every time you see him, it's, you know, something else. And until, like, till the very end when he's got his own little cult under him.
Different spiritual leader every time.
But, yeah, like I said, so I guess I just thought maybe they were going to go somewhere, especially this being set in West Texas. And just I thought there was going to be sort of a comment on something, but it just doesn't really. It is what it is. So we briefly meet Mox's parents as he heads out the door to go to school. His friend Billy Bob picks him up. Billy Bob and his pig Bacon. I think Wendell and Tweeter are also in the truck at this point.
They pick up Tweeter.
Okay. And then after that, they stop to pick up quarterback Lance Harbor, Paul Walker, slow-mo tracking shot as he comes out of his house. Donna, you said, I couldn't tell earlier if you were kidding when you were talking about them shooting Paul Walker as if there was a halo around him the entire time.
I really, you know what? I was half kidding, but it's kind of true.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He's lit like a golden boy. Every picture of him is absolutely shiny and glowing. His eyes are twinkling. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous, but it's watching it now was sort of like, oh, heck, you know?
This is the first Paul Walker movie I've watched since he passed.
Me too.
Oh, actually, you know what? No, I saw Pleasantville. Never mind. I'm sorry.
Oh. Yeah, I forgot he was in that. I had no idea he was in this.
Yeah.
Hidden gem. Mm-hmm.
Actually, in some ways, I think that Lance, there's a version of this movie that's more interesting that's kind of about Lance. But this is where the true intentions and tone of the movie are made clear. And I'll say that by the end of this, I had a turnaround on a few of these characters. But for a large chunk of the running time, I didn't really like a lot of them. And Tweeter in particular, I think, is repulsive.
Yeah.
And if you look at something like American Pie, which, as Donna mentioned, came out this same year, and a character like Steve Stifler, you can make this type of over-the-top, hypersexual, you know, misogynistic comic relief character work. But the thing with Stifler is that those movies know he's repulsive. They treat him that way. The other characters treat him that way. And right. for all the times you're laughing with him, there are more instances of where you're laughing at him. And that's the big difference. Those filmmakers are in on the joke. They do not think Stifler's a cool guy. So,
yeah, I think Tweeter comes off as way more rapey than I remember.
he's pretty rapey.
He's pretty much a rapist, but yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't remember that as a kid, so.
At first I thought the joke later on about him maybe having an STD was sort of like, okay, well we should take that into consideration, I guess, when you're talking about Tweeter and his behavior and everything. But for me, that moment does not absolve the rest of the time he's on screen, primarily because it's just a punchline. It's not actually a consequence or something that's going to come up ever again. It's a joke. It's the only reason it's there. And for the rest of the
really funny joke, though.
Well, but for the rest,
so gross.
For the rest of the film, he's still treated like a hero, and fine. That's that's the character. That's their choice. But I do want us to keep that in mind when we talk about Darcy later on. Just the difference in the way the film treats these two characters. So they get to school and there's a pep rally for the game that night. This is our first look at John Voight as Coach Kilmer. And this dude fucking crushes it. Like, he is a real bright spot in this movie me. Every second he's on screen held my interest. Like, they turn him into more of a cartoony villain by the end, and I wasn't so hot on that, and I did want them to dig into his character a little more. But speaking strictly of the performance here, not the writing, just John Voight himself, he is pretty awesome in this.
This is actually one of my favorite John Voight performances. Now that I've seen more John Voight movies, this is up there. It's like in my top five John Voight performances.
I believe in him as this coach. As broadly as the character's written, I do think, like, casting him is sort of a masterstroke. And when, like, and I do get the sense he's committed to this, because if I'm thinking of something like Anaconda, which maybe came out a couple years after this, but, you know, sort of late 90s, early 2000s. That to me is John Voight not giving a fuck. Like, just kind of like, I'm going to buy a great boat after this. Like, that's, and I really don't get that sense at all here. I do think there was an in with this character. I think he found something to latch onto here. He really seems to be going for something. So, Mox's girlfriend, Jules, can't wait for the football season to end. He reminds her it's only five more games. She's Lance's sister as well, but she's just not into the game or the culture surrounding it. Mox sees Lance getting an injection of painkillers. It's our first indicator that Kilmer cares more about winning than about them as people. Okay, and then there's this scene of Mox reading Vonnegut during practice. Which really pisses off Kilmer. And this is what I meant about being misled by what I thought was the premise, because usually the dilemma in a movie like this is something along the lines of, like, well, you can't play ball unless you get your grades up. So this seemed like a great reversal, having a main character who was a good athlete, but who was just more interested in studying and academic stuff. I thought that was going to be the main conflict of the movie, but it's not. Mox is instantly a great quarterback. His teammates love him. They never question his loyalty. And even though there are some mentions of Brown University and a scholarship, Mox is never really put in a position where his loyalties are divided or he has to make a hard choice, even when it seems like they're setting that up. And there are at least two or three moments where it feels like they are. They almost always avoid the more interesting conflict or opportunity. And I think they chose the most boring way possible for the Mox and Kilmer situation to resolve itself. I'm not talking about the staging of the scene, because Kilmer's last scene I don't have an issue with, just how we get there. I'll save my thoughts on that till we get closer to it. But yeah, so this was just another moment of reconciling, like, what I thought I was getting into, and then sort of taking a step back to be like, okay, well, hold on. Let me wait and see how this plays out and where they're going with this. So the guys play their game, they win. There's that house party afterwards to celebrate the victory. We see Mox checking out head cheerleader Darcy, played by Allie Larder. Jules doesn't think too much of her. And the line, it costs a lot. It costs a lot of money to look that cheap, is actually pretty good. I kind of like that part.
I think that's a Dolly Partonism.
Is it?
I think it is.
Oh, yeah. Shit. Well, never mind, Varsity Blues.
Yeah.
Praise revoked. There's some more tension mounting between Mox and Kilmer and, you know, blah, blah, blah. We see all that. The barbecue scene.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, there's this rivalry between Lance's father and Mox's father. There is no such rivalry between Mox and Lance. They remain the bestest of buds throughout the entire movie. But this is where you see just how much Mox hates his father, how much he resents what his father wants for him. And to me, this is the pinnacle of bad acting and directing in this movie. Like the misplaced Hitchcock vertigo zoom that serves no purpose, like the ludicrous close-ups and the performances, like Paul Walker and James Vanderbeek are fine, but the parents, especially Lance's dad,
yes.
It feels like an SNL skit. He's without horrible punchlines.
And the route that he runs to catch the ball. It's like, I'm sorry, that's not impressing anyone. That's like my 2-year-old daughter can catch that pass. It was the worst, like the clunkiest staging and the worst acting of probably the entire movie.
By far. Just the directorial choices were baffling to me, but Lance's dad in general is just not one of the stronger actors in the film. And right. And this scene in particular just seems like, what the, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's not his fault. Maybe he was asked to do something, you know, bigger and more heightened. I don't know.
Did you guys notice who Lance's brother is?
It's Landry.
It's Landry.
Landry. I wrote it so big.
I've seen this.
Why do I not even remember that Lance had a brother?
Okay, so he's got a little brother, and
is he Lance's, just in this scene?
Lance's dad is talking about how they're gonna hold back his brother.
Right.
So that he'll be bigger freshman year, which, sad to say, is something that happens in sports.
Oh, I was
going to
say that. That's in my notes. That's another thing I wish maybe like. Anyway.
Yeah, but it's Landry from Friday Night Lights, and this is not the only connection to Friday Night Lights that this movie will have. The series Friday Night Lights. This movie will have at least two other connections to it, and he's also in Breaking Bad. Mm. So there's that too. Connected to everything.
Everything. Jesse Plemons is everywhere.
Jesse Plemons as a little boy.
As a tiny boy. I think, okay, so yes, Mr. Harbor is terrible. And this is one of the many aspects of this movie that just seems like they turned up the volume so loud and I didn't really need them to. You know, these characters are so extreme that it does lose a little bit of what could have, you know, maybe a few degrees back could have been a little bit more genuine. I could have actually felt what I was supposed to feel for them. Mm-hmm. But he's so heightened and he's so extreme that he really becomes very silly. And I think most of the parents become very silly, and the way that they reminisce and the way, you know, we got a guy who graduated in 1980 who never misses a party that the high school kids throw. I mean, it's just a little bit extreme. And I think there's...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I think there's a good stories and certainly some truth to those characters that are living the glory days, you know, over and over. There's nothing else going on in this small town, but it's just an eense too much in a lot of the ways. So it does cross over into just comical to me.
This scene in particular is the one that I thought was, because there, I don't really, I'm not, I'm not totally on board with like the tone of the movie overall, but I do. Mm. But this scene, I think, is the only one that I found jarring, where it was like, I would really totally like not just a preference thing, but sort of objectively just an awful scene. But and the thing with like the guy that hangs around at the party, that so that was something that was I that felt more. When I was in college, there were guys like that that were still hanging around college parties. Mm-hmm. They just never moved out of the town. So I that part of it isn't really what bugged me about that scene. It was sort of just how fucking mean-spirited that moment was. And it was – but it was played for laughs. And I just thought like, what the – this isn't funny. This guy's a dick. And like we're just – we're – because it's not like they portrayed that character as he wasn't like an alpha male, aggressive, like bull, like trying to hang with these guys. He was kind of a quiet, you know, sort of like kind of just more of like a sad character. And that just so then that makes the guys we're supposed to be rooting for look like the bullies.
Right.
So, well, then, OK, so we get the scene of them in their sex ed class. I'm going to skip right past the teacher because we'll deal with her later. Believe you me. But the main part of this scene is when Billy Bob collapses. The nurse tells him he shouldn't play that night. Kilmer basically tells him, suck it up. You know, he doesn't care what the nurse says. This is I like this moment of Kilmer kind of manipulating him. And I think they're like the dynamic between Kilmer and Billy Bob, I think, is actually is one of the better parts of the film right up until the very, very end. Like the but stuff like this, I did really enjoy. So, yeah, Billy Bob's in the game, even though he shouldn't be. This, of course, leads to Lance getting injured because Billy Bob is not there to cover for him. And so you think. Or, well, what I was thinking at this moment was like, oh, okay, you know, just a few games away from the championship, and now they're stuck with a guy who's been on the bench all year and doesn't even seem that interested in football. But guess what? Mox goes in. He does great. He even runs a different play than the one Coach Kilmer told him to and still scores. And my notes for this scene say, wait, what? He's awesome right away. This movie sucks. and then I thought this is another instance of like, okay, ease up. Let's wait and see where they go with this. So after the game, we move to the hospital where doctors inform Lance's family that he's finished playing ball for the foreseeable future. And
really forever. Really, like in 1999,
yeah.
The injury he had, he'll never play football again.
But they're sort and they're sort of saying best case scenario, he's not going to be like up and at him again for months. So that's
yeah.
That's the you're right. Year and a half. I'm sorry. Year and a half. Yeah.
Yeah. So, he's going to have to have – he blew up every ligament in his knee. Yeah.
And so, scholarship is out playing. Yeah. So professional career over. So
obviously, yeah.
Mox leaves the hospital and Darcy, who is, you know, Lance's girlfriend.
Wait. Before we get to that, I'm sorry. Before we get to that, because this is going to be a major turn. There is some interesting information delivered by the doctor that the doctor is surprised he hadn't been hurt before because his knee was full of scar tissue.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's because he had been hurting that knee over and over again.
Well, that's,
and the coach had been shooting him up with presumably cortisone shots so that he could go out there and play.
Right.
Right. So the coach has been running him into the ground. To the point where, like, you know, any tackle might have snapped his knee in half.
Well, and the more sinister part of it, actually, is when the coach is also standing right there and he says, well, this is the first I'm hearing about it.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
And Mox knows he's lying. That's why he tells
we've seen
him to get out of there.
Mox just saw him injecting, just in Lance's knee. So
exactly.
But yeah, so.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. So Mox leaves the hospital. Darcy, you know, immediately is all up on him, stripping and whatnot. Quite frankly, you guys, I thought this was disgusting. And the way the film treats this character really, really bothered me. So, I mean, well, we can really dig into that in just a scene or two. But so the team still has their victory party. Not one word is spoken about Lance. No one seems that upset. And you know
right.
what? Why should they be? Up to this point, we've been led to believe that he was the team. Like, he was the reason they were going all the way. But instead of any of that really being at stake or up in the air, they just kind of get another superstar to take his place. So who cares?
And yeah, they're fine.
Tweeter, he steals the cop car. And the next time we see it, he's driving around. He's naked. There's a bunch of naked women in there with him. He finds Mox outside a convenience store where he's just been given free booze because he's already a hero to everybody in the town. Later on, we'll hear the cops talking about how these boys are out of control. And it's another idea that's presented and goes nowhere. The fact that they're running wild but get off the hook because football is so important to this community. Like, even the idea of a town with misplaced priorities is interesting. But acknowledging ideas is not the same thing as actually exploring them. And
Right. It
makes me wonder why moments like this were included at all. Like, there's hardly anything in the movie that ever amounts to something more as far as these big ideas go. There is a nice moment here with Lance in the hospital room listening to the radio and hearing the commentators talk about Mox stepping out of Lance's shadow and really coming into his own, and they're having this great game. And it's great because Lance has no lines, but you get what he's feeling. And and this is part of what I meant about Lance almost having the more engaging story. But unfortunately, this is yet another instance of something that is not going to be touched on again. And it's one of the many reasons there should be some sort of conflict between Mox and Lance later on, but it just never happens. So then we get the infamous whipped cream bikini scene. I have to wonder what Darcy was going to do if he didn't want whipped cream. Just come out holding two cherries over her nipples? I don't know. Apparently this is actually shaving cream that she's covered in because whipped cream melts under hot lights. And But yeah, just absolutely fuck this so hard. They throw in this sad backstory for Darcy where Lance was her ticket out of this town, and that's why she's so desperate to hook up with Mox now. I don't think a storyline like this it couldn't work, but it bothers me that she needs a reason to behave the way she does and Tweeter gets to run around like an asshole just because. And it bothers me that once she's no longer a sex object, the film has no idea what to do with her. She disappears from the movie. She gets
gone. A
close-up, you know, or two during the big game at the end. That's it. They have no use for her beyond this. So the attempt to humanize her here feels a little hypocritical to me. And the way Mox says, oh, you'll get out of here on your own, or whatever it is. Like, how? Because that's the end of it. We'll never know. Like, they obviously weren't interested in telling her story. And this feels like something that either you give it the attention that it deserves, or you just drop it all together. But this is just, this felt like wildly misguided to me, this scene.
I also felt like she was way too aware of that situation in her life too quickly. Like, it seemed like she actually liked Lance.
Yeah.
So as soon as Lance gets hurt, for her to just switch her motives.
Yeah.
Seemed like really, like, not possible, frankly. Especially because, like, you know, the whole idea that, like, I guess what, there's four games left to the season or whatever. So she's like, I better get on this quick.
Yeah.
Because this guy's, you know, the quarterback now. That didn't seem realistic
trifling.
To me.
What'd you say, Dana?
Said bitches be trifling.
Thank you.
That's when you select that chapter on the DVD, that's the title of it.
That's what it says, yeah.
Go ahead.
I have some Ellie Larder memories and observations, if you don't mind.
No, please.
So first of all, I remember the whipped cream bikini having straps all the way around.
Oh. A more conservative whipped cream
bikini.
How did
she do that?
Yeah, and I don't
you
know how.
A whipped cream,
like,
one piece.
Yeah, it changed in my mind because I guess I wasn't focused where I should have been focused. But and I remember thinking, like, isn't that so messy when your arms rub around those fake whipped cream straps? but there were no straps because why would you put straps?
Because that's ridiculous, right?
And also, I completely forgot that she was even in this movie. Somehow, my memories, like Allie Larder first comes into my frame of reference as a fully formed and classy adult. Like,
you never saw like
clothes on
Final Destination. Those like the,
no,
she's in
I
a few
didn't.
Of those. Oh wow,
I
okay.
did not see Final Destination. And so I guess I'm trying to, and I looked at her filmography, trying to think where this image came from.
Legally Blonde.
Of maybe, yeah, partly Legally Blonde, yeah. And also around that time she did, I think, a few magazine interviews where like they took pictures of her beautiful home, which is really well kept and designed and everything. So in my mind, she's like the most adult, classy person ever, and forgetting that she was in this movie, and all of a sudden seeing this throwback of this, like I think Tweeter says, like she fell out of the "I want to suck your dick" tree and hit every branch on the way down.
Yeah,
I was like, yeah. Oh, I loved her armoire.
As you keep talking about her, how classy she is, all I can see is her farting in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Oh my God.
Because she sells the shit out of that moment. She is so funny at that part. And like, I'm not trying to take anything away from her. I really do.
No.
When I was like at 19, 20, I had like a awfully big crush on Allie Larder.
She is something special.
I will forever be spoiled on Allie Larder because of Heroes.
Oh, yeah.
She's so, like, she's not bad at it, but her, again, they didn't know what to do with Allie Larder on Heroes. And she is, it's one of the worst story arcs for any actor on any TV show ever.
No.
Yeah.
Well, you know the other thing that kind of has changed how successfully this whipped cream scene might work is that, first of all, just because I'd never seen the movie, I was aware, I knew about this scene. I knew about "I don't want your laugh." I mean, I was aware of the film. And having seen Not Another Teen Movie and Chris Evans do this scene, you can never take part seriously ever again. Like him turning around and having the banana in his butt, that's like all I'm thinking about when this scene is playing now.
Isn't while they're doing this scene, isn't it like Aaliyah's "If Your Girl Only Knew" playing?
Yes.
I mean, like that's a little too crazy. On the nose. Yeah. It might as well have been "Creep" by TLC.
Let me. The other thing I wanted to say was that I really do like the actor that plays Wendell. Lyle Swinton is his name.
Yeah.
This is the only movie he's been in. He did play football professionally, I think, for a little bit. But so Wendell is telling Mox that Coach Kilmer is racist. And how have you never realized this? He never lets Wendell run the ball for a touchdown. And he thinks this is going to affect his chances of getting a scholarship, being scouted, you know, all that. And I found myself wishing for a version of this where Mox wasn't magically perfect at everything right away, where he did struggle as the quarterback and was at odds with some of his teammates for not taking this as seriously as they did. And, you know, and maybe his family can't afford to send him to Brown. And so the scholarship through football becomes like his last hope. And I can see him learning the value of the game along the way and learning to be a team player instead of always coming across like he's sort of above all of this and using moments like this with Wendell to win over the other players, especially if the last quarterback was the hot shot who got all the glory. Like maybe Lance didn't need these other guys to win really, or he didn't need to rely on them as much. But because Mox isn't as good as Lance, he realizes that he does need guys to lean on, guys like Wendell, and they can't play the same way they did when they had Lance. And maybe Kilmer doesn't understand that, and that's why they're butting heads. So I'm done. What am I doing? I know no one cares what I do. Never mind.
I have always felt, even when I watched it the first time, that this scene feels really tacked on.
Well, all of them kind of do. Any big moment like this does.
Well, just the idea that the idea that Kilmer is suddenly racist as well, as if like there wasn't enough reason to not like him. Now we're like, you have to not like him because also he's
well,
a
racist. The second half of the movie really starts piling on, like, let's make sure you know this guy's fucking Darth Vader.
I just felt like in this scene, it never rang true to me that a high school football coach who has won 22 straight division titles has never let a black man score.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't ring true to me, because this movie wasn't set in this, you know, in the 70s, and he's been coaching since the 60s or 50s even, you know, like it doesn't, this part, you know, he was coaching in the 80s and 90s. He had black running backs and black wide receivers. They were playing in an integrated school system, you know?
Yeah.
It just never rang true that it, matter of fact, it always to me feels like Wendell is like whining. It always felt like he's complaining. And then as he tells Mox, like, you don't know what I'm talking about. Like, you don't hear me. You don't see what I'm talking about. And then as soon as Mox says, well, we're going to change that, he goes, I like you, Mox.
Well, see, this is what I'm saying.
It's like, so it feels like to me, well, real quick, it just feels like Mox, that scene, I know it's not the intention of the screenplay, but it feels like he's being manipulated by Wendell.
Yeah, so we're in total agreement that it comes out of nowhere and it doesn't feel earned. But I think that's true of most of the moments in this movie. But and what you're saying is interesting, because you're absolutely right. The way the film wants to play this is it's very obvious that no, John Voight is in fact racist. But because this is structured so haphazardly, and because a lot of this doesn't feel genuine, it does wind up having the opposite effect, which is that Wendell is lying. Here, that it's that he's making excuses for why he never gets to run the ball, and that Mox is sort of buying into it. And so what I'm saying is that, like, I not that I like this moment, but that I can see a version of this movie that is more about, like, Mox not instantly being embraced as the new quarterback and having to use moments like this in order to win over the other players and to recognize, like, okay, well, this is how we can be a better team. This is how I can be a better quarterback, you know, to like, just to, and to know them on a level that maybe Lance never bothered to. It's a totally different movie. And I couldn't help it as I was watching this to kind of start thinking, like, there's a good movie in here somewhere. I don't think this isn't like impossible.
I couldn't stop thinking about it through the frame of what Friday Night Lights did with similar storylines.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and not, you know, the movie is also very good, but specifically the TV show had time to, like, delve into each of these issues and make them into, you know, give them the kind of weight that they deserve instead of just kind of throwing everything into one, you know, blender.
Well, the film does have, sure, the benefit of a TV show. Yeah, obviously you get a lot more room for character development and stuff. But I think this film has plenty of running time to establish all of this, well, most of this stuff, and to embellish upon it. As evidenced by the fact that I think, like I said, for the most part, 80% of Billy Bob's storyline works, and it's not like they needed to devote a ton of screen time to it, but enough that it has a natural, like, evolution and conclusion. Like, that was within the realm of possibility. Like, they're throwing so much at the wall here. And it just starts to feel like, well, as long as we mention this, well, then we get credit for that being an actual subplot. But you can't just have like five lines in a scene and then go like, check. Okay, moving on.
Yeah, that's like saying insane. Saved by the Bell
really dealt with race.
That would be like saying Saved by the Bell dealt with addiction, because they had an episode where Jesse Spano was addicted to speed for 12 minutes.
But even that gets more attention than a lot of the moments in this. So
I think I agree with you, definitely. But it's to me, it seemed like in this movie that there never was really anything that bad that we were actually fighting against, but these kids sort of felt like they needed more of a villain than they had. So I think you end up with a little overly, or not even the kids, the screenwriters were like, we need a bigger, something evil. What are we going to fight against? And all of a sudden you get all these like crazy, silly.
And it's
huge. And this one scene where this girl can't get out of town because she's a girl. And you're like, oh, nope, you totally can because you're smart. Go
ahead.
Because
it's 1999. And what the fuck?
Yeah, exactly. So there's nothing. Our president was just having too many BJs. That was our big trouble. Like, what are you going to rage against? Rage against what machine? You're mean to me when you tell me to
win. That was
win.
A really odd detour for the movie to take, all the Bill Clinton blowjob stuff. I mean, come on, guys. That really was the, that's what broke the straw that broke the camel's back. Donna, that's absolutely true. And I wish somebody at some point had realized maybe we don't need a truly 100% evil villain for this. Like, maybe they can just not get along and that's enough and they have their reasons. Like, if you know you're in real trouble when D3, the Mighty Ducks, has a more nuanced evil coach than your movie. But it does. I mean, they show another side to him. There winds up being a reason he treats the kids the way that he does. We never get any of that here. And even though he's like one-dimensional, that certainly is sort of a problem as well. But the bigger problem is, yeah, just the way they feel they need to keep hammering home just how nasty this guy, that there has to be a villain to overcome is kind of crazy. And the other thing you were saying about these kids, like, not having anything to really rebel against, and so they're kind of getting all worked up about stuff that doesn't really mean anything, that would be okay, too, if I believed the filmmakers were aware of that at all, because there is a movie like that. It's a lot like this premise. Mm-hmm. It's called Dazed and Confused. It's about a bunch of football players who gets all worked up about something that everybody else is going like, are you serious? Your life is like fucking perfect. What are you so mad about? Like, what is the real issue here? And so if that's more of what they were going for here, I think it's pretty clear that was not, that's not what they intended. That this is just like, no.
It's pretty heavy-handed. Yeah. It's pretty dramatic. I mean, every moment of this movie is underscored with trumpets and strings building. Like, the horn section is ridiculous. And every time you turn around, somebody's having a way too big a feeling. And then cue the horns. It's sort of incredible. I wrote horns like 30 times in my notes because everything that happens, I'm like, wait a minute. I don't even remember where we are in the movie, but I'll fucking bet you there's a big
trust
set
the
of
horns.
Horns.
Yeah, follow
you
the
know,
horns.
For as melodramatic as this movie is, and it is plenty melodramatic, it's amazing that Billy Bob survives till the end of the film. Weren't you kind of expecting, like, I know, I mean, obviously because I've seen it, I know what happens, but every time that the whole sequence with the pig where he leaves bacon, I'm like, oh, yeah. He's going to kill himself.
Oh, I thought that's where it was going for sure.
Yeah, when you hear the gunshot, you're like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah, but Billy Bob. But
the movie is very melodramatic, but in that one scene where it totally would have been earned by the melodramatic laws of the film, it doesn't. It's like, no, he's just drunk and he's shooting at bottles.
You missed a real great horn opportunity movie.
You really could have set him free.
Well, so there's the scene where Mox takes the guys out to a strip club and they find out their sex ed teacher is one of the strippers there. I can't even. This is disgusting. This is so disgusting.
Before we get too far into hating this scene, does anyone remember the name of the strip club in Friday Night Lights?
Is it the Landing Strip also?
It's the Landing Strip in this one. This is the other connection to Friday Night Lights.
Okay.
It's the same strip club.
Okay. I mean, I'm not going to go on like another rant here. That's pretty much how I feel. It's disgusting. And I don't think it's funny. No. The fact that the punchline is just, oh, she has to take her clothes off for money. Oh my God. It's just barf, whatever.
I think that the moment when she sees them, and she's like, she turns and she sees a table full of her students. is mortifying.
Yeah.
And then they all point and laugh at her.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, God.
It's another mean-spirited scene.
Yeah, that's a very... But then the next scene, she's drinking with them.
Which that also feels grotesque, just in a different way.
Okay, a lot of this movie, and especially, like I said, a lot of the stuff that deals with male-female relationships, a lot of this feels like we're supposed to hate them, but you know the writers didn't intend that.
Yeah.
Like, it almost, like, you know, like when you watch, like, a character study film about someone that you're supposed to be, like, repulsed by, and everything written in the story is like, see how repulsing this guy is? That's what a lot of this feels like, but that's not what they intended.
No, this is
they
not the Wolf
to be like,
of
Look
Wall
how cool
Street.
It is.
This is, yeah.
Right.
Honestly, this scene doesn't really bother me that much. It's an MTV movie, and they got to squeeze in a bunch of boobs. So go to the strip club, hot for a teacher, you know?
Is this the only MTV movie with nudity in it?
Oh, gosh. I'm sure there's got to be. Lord, I only watched MTV movies for, like, 5 years max before I was like, I can't understand what they're saying anymore. Back to my taxes, you know?
Back to my taxes?
That's when I became an adult. That's what it sounded like.
I see.
It's weird, and it's gross, and the boys are gross, and they point at her, and it's really embarrassing.
Yes.
Can I say my favorite thing about the strip club scene happens as they're leaving it? And what a dumb move also, because you could have easily gone to the strip club the night after the game, not the night before the game.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a really rookie mistake for these guys, but whatever. But so they're leaving the strip club and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe we've stayed until 5 a.m. It's clearly the next day. The sun is shining bright and these poor drunken boys are stumbling out of this strip club and right behind them, there are two totally normal looking, like clean cut teenage girls that leave the strip club right after they do.
I thought I wasn't looking that close. I thought maybe it was like strippers getting off work. I don't know.
They looked like regular high school girls.
Huh.
Like, I mean, if you see this again.
Yeah, where was that movie? Why weren't we watching?
Yeah.
And it's just like Megan and Mandy being like, oh, we always study here.
Yeah.
like, they're so nonchalant. And they're so, I looked at it the second time, because I watched the movie more than once. And so I looked again very closely. I was like, wait a minute. Now, maybe I'm just not looking. And these are actually like supposed to be strippers. These are clean-cut, well-parented girls leaving immediately after the football team.
Well-parented.
Not that well-parented, it turns out. But
I guess not. I don't know.
Well, there's also a moment in the strip club where Lance tells Mox what a good friend he is. And I thought for sure he was about to find out that Mox made out with Darcy or... Mm-hmm. You express some jealousy over Mox becoming the superstar, but, you know, hey, why put your characters in a tough spot?
Nope. They're cool.
yeah, so the fact that they were out drinking all night really fucks up the next game. Kilmer tears into them, especially Billy Bob, who he blames for losing Lance, and that's rough because Billy Bob is a pretty lovable guy. I'm saying a lot of shitty things about the movie, but I do like Billy Bob. So... Mox's father confronts him about all this, and that's where we get the most famous line from the movie. Donna, you do it pretty well. Do you wanna do it for us?
I don't want your life.
and then yeah, this leads into the, you know, what we thought was Billy Bob's drunken suicide. I do like most of this scene. It's, you know, him drunk shooting his old football trophies. I think this is a good performance. I do think there's a progression to Billy Bob scenes. And if they hadn't botched just the very, very end of this, I'd be even more enthusiastic about it. But even still, I mean, to me, he's the one that registers most as an actual character. It doesn't feel right to me that he switches allegiances so quickly at the end of this scene, that he goes from worshiping Coach Kilmer to fuck Coach Kilmer in about 5 seconds. But But otherwise, this is a solid scene. I read an interview with Ron Lester, the actor who plays Billy Bob. He said that when they shot this, he had just found out Frank Sinatra died, and that's where a lot of the tears were coming from.
Oh, my God.
And I was kind of like, I wish I didn't know that, because I was just so like, man, he is so good in this scene. I mean, it shouldn't take away anything, I guess, but...
He really, now I'm going to think, man, he really loves old Blue Eyes.
Right.
He did. He was a big fan.
Yeah, because I mean, I found out Frank Sinatra died, and then I, like, walked to the corner store and bought a Yoo-Hoo. I didn't, like, cry.
This one's for you, Frank, spilled a little out on the sidewalk.
It's like, that's sad. I'm going to keep listening to NSYNC.
I like that you say NSYNC. You say the letter. You don't... NSYNC.
How else would you say it?
You're right. You're right.
How else would you say that?
I am a fool.
The thing that I say again, this is the end of the scene, is just like the funniest way to go out to me. These are like back to back stacking up. So yeah, he changes allegiance really quickly, and JVB shoots a picture of Coach Kilmer. Right. And so immediately after he blows the face off of Kilmer, you see Billy Bob is going to throw his liquor bottle right at it. And so you see the close up of this guy's face exploding. And I feel like the cinematography sets up, I'm expecting to see the bottle smash into this picture, and it just doesn't ever. So it just looks like he threw it really poorly to me.
Well, also, it's a little just like, underwhelming.
I hate you.
Like, maybe throw the liquor and then shoot the face off. Otherwise, it's like, your face is gone. Also, take this.
Exactly.
I mean, doesn't it also effort, seem
like
really
the
bad.
Doesn't it also seem like the subtext of this shot of this scene is, now we got to kill Coach Kilmer.
A little bit.
Like, it's time. He's gone too far. He's broken Billy Bob. Like, I have
we've gushed
him.
Over each other's best, butts but... long enough. Let's get down to murder.
I do think that you said his name was Ron Clemens. Is that what you said?
No.
Ron Burgundy? Rick Santino. What's his
You're
name?
Getting warmer. Ron Lester.
Ron Lester, Ron Clemens Lester. I think the reason that his storyline works so well, aside from being one of the better written storylines in the film, is that he is a good actor.
Yeah.
He's playing this guy who is basically popular because he does one thing really well. But if it weren't for that thing, he'd be a total outcast because he's so large. But because he can protect a quarterback really well, you know, like he is one of the kings of the town. Yeah. But you can see that insecurity in him the whole time. I really enjoyed his performance. Yeah.
He's really great.
Yeah.
Ron Clemens.
Ron Clemens.
Mox gets his acceptance letter from Brown. More importantly, this is where we see the little brother has his own cult, which is hysterical. Coach Kilmer tells Mox he'll mess with his transcripts and ruin his chances of going to Brown unless Mox falls in line. This to me is just like the height of just so unnecessary. So like we've gone full blown mustache twirler with Kilmer.
Yes. Also the dad's response. Yeah, I'm really proud about Brown, but we got to talk about this game coming up. I'm sorry. Your son just got a full
so silly.
A full scholarship to an Ivy League institution. Like, be proud of your son. That did so not ring silly. True at all.
No.
No.
So
it did not.
The big game starts. Wendell goes down, he's injured. It's another situation where he shouldn't keep playing, but Kilmer doesn't care. They're about to inject him, and this is the last straw for Mox and the other players. They tell Wendell not to do it, and Mox starts a chain reaction of exits. One by one, they all start to quit, and they won't go back on the field unless it's without Coach Kilmer. I like this, but I found myself wondering if this would have played even better with Billy Bob in Wendell's place, because it feels more like the natural conclusion to his storyline. Like if his breakdown earlier hadn't ended with, fuck Coach Kilmer, but instead maybe just ended with Mox planting a seed of mistrust. Mm-hmm. And then this becomes a nice way of visually showing Billy Bob torn between Mox and Coach Kilmer. And it feels like this is the moment he realizes Kilmer is not the father figure he thought, that he does not care about him the way that his team does, because Wendell already hated Kilmer. Like, right. Billy Bob should have been the last one to lose loyalty, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, that's probably true.
So
yeah.
Kilmer goes off quietly into the night. That's another good scene, actually, where he realizes no one's followed him out of the locker room. Man, John.
And he's just standing there in the hallway.
He's so good in that scene. Because it's almost like that's even what I just said is sort of inaccurate. It's kind of like he knows even as he's going out the door. And there's just that like silent acceptance of what the situation here is. And yeah, it's a really good scene. And it's just
a really good scene.
But even better if we hadn't turned him into a Disney villain at this point. Like if he had just been a more well-rounded character where there would be like some legitimate sympathy for him right here, that I think would have been a pretty incredible moment. But
so we need one shot of Emilio Estevez showing James Vanderbeek. that Kilmer also plays football with his handicapped daughter.
Something. I mean, that's more D3. They gave it more effort there than they do in this movie. Aww. But
and he's just like launching footballs at her.
Oh no! I actually did not like this scene.
Oh wow!
I thought it was really heavy-handed and gross.
Wait, what part of it? Him specifically? Him walking out?
Yeah. Everything is so melodramatic. And even when they're like telling him off, a team turning on a coach is so dramatic and it's so huge. And I think it's a story that could be really interestingly told, but this was all sort of too silly leading up into these fake injuries and him like hiding things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not talking so much about how they turn on him or, you know, Vanderbeek's big speech right after, which is fucking awful. But like, I'm talking just specifically about John Voight and his face and everything you can read off of his expression. Just as he leaves that locker room, like, come on, here we go. And realizing he's by himself. I just really liked that moment.
I think at the very first part of it, I'm like, oh my God, okay, that's like working. But we're just with him for so long, and it gets so uncomfortable for me, and not having – I'm just not with it the whole way.
It kind of feels like it's a scene out of a better movie, and what is it doing here? This doesn't really – get this scene.
Yeah.
You don't get to have
this. It's just these shitty 90 kids who are whining because they have like – almost too much allowance, like like, you know, I'm just like, oh god, you guys are kind of just being shitty about like and yeah, he's shooting you full of, but that even seems weird, and he like knows he's hiding it, which it never really seemed to work for me, his like sneaky like don't know what any of y'all are talking about. I'm like, I don't know. Made me feel weird.
I've never considered it before. Basically because the last time I watched this, I was probably 22. Like, I was still dumb and stupid and young. But I think your point is like incredibly valid. He is not the villain that this movie makes him out to be. He is not a good person. By no means is he a good person, but he's shooting up his players with painkillers so that they can play on injuries, which is really common they do it legitimately in professional sports now. But but other than his handling of Billy Bob's concussion, I never bought the racism thing. Mm-hmm. This goes back to that. Like, that was not well enough established or earned. So I didn't buy that. He doesn't really, I mean, he threatens to mess with Mox's transcripts, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, totally.
Because he has no access to those transcripts and whatever. But so yeah, I do think you're right. I don't think it's earned how much vitriol is out there for him, but taken completely just on its face, out of context, the moment when he is standing outside of that locker room waiting for his players and they're not coming, and he's still trying to come on, let's go, let's get out there, is heartbreaking. Mm.
As much
as I've hated this character throughout the movie, I feel so bad for him in that moment. And I think that's a testament to John Voight's performance, but I feel so bad for this man because this has been his life for the last quarter century, and it's gone. It's gone, and it's, largely, I guess, his fault, according to the rules of this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
But, because he's apparently racist and apparently does not care about the well-being of his children that he's coaching. But I just think that one moment in this, is an island surrounded by really melodramatic moments. I think that moment is really touching and moving. I think it's a great point that he's not the bad guy that this film would have you believe he is.
Donna, would you have preferred something where, like, instead of vilifying the coach to this point and then having to, send him away, like, where they have, even if it's sort of like working together begrudgingly or just sort of recognizing, like, we're both, we have different ways of doing things, but we got the same goal here, and maybe more of a making amends with Mox, like that type of situation.
Yeah, I think that would have maybe worked better, and that they just sort of learned to work together. The other thing, on like a football nerd standpoint,
I know what you're gonna say.
If this team is a running team, yeah, then why does it matter who the fuck the quarterback is? It doesn't matter at all. And that's what you've been saying, like, it just doesn't matter. If that's all you're gonna do is run the ball, then put anybody in there. I'll do it, for God's sakes. We'll still win games. But and if it had been if Harbor had a really great cannon of an arm and Mox can't really throw or can only make short passes, just kind of like your Jason Street and Matt Saracen situation, they do it a little better in Friday Night Lights. Some stakes football-wise. So, yeah, maybe you coach him enough, or this guy's like, no, I have a smarter idea that my short passes can get it done if we're smart about what we do down the field. But, they're just a running team who's going to run it either way.
That's exactly what I was saying before, about just a small detail about them having to change the way they play.
That would have been... Yeah. And then they work to find their way together.
And then there's still a conflict between Mox and the coach. It's just a more believable, we don't need a traditional hero and villain here. This is not, doesn't have to be that type of story.
It's really funny because they do change the way they play, but they change it the other way. They throw more.
Yeah.
And they put five wide receiver sets, and everyone's counting the wide receivers like they've never seen a five wide receiver set before.
Right. And to the point where then you start to wonder, why the fuck wasn't he just starting in the first place if he's this amazing?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But, and what was the point of having a pro caliber quarterback in an offense where you don't ever pass? Also, another football nerd moment. When Billy Bob has his, blacks out and Harbor gets hurt, that was a false start. Mm. That play should never have happened. Falls before the snap.
Doesn't that make it a false start? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Donna.
Okay, so really quick, Mox makes his big speech. They give him the slow clap at the end of it, which also barf.
What a slow clap.
They return to the field with Lance calling the shots, which is another thing I kind of liked, actually.
Oh, yeah, I did too.
So, yeah, they win the game. Everyone lives happily ever after. And the end. Final thoughts on Varsity Blues, Donna?
Oh, my goodness. This is such a movie.
It is definitely a movie.
That's what it says on the box. Yeah. This is technically a movie.
That's what the quote should say. This is technically a movie.
It fulfills all the parameters of a full-length feature.
I think sort of James Vanderbeek's last voiceover as he's taking us out of the movie kind of sums up part of the problem with the movie. A big part of the problem is that there's really nothing to fight against, and these kids are so lazy. Because the last line of the movie is like, that statue still stands, but only because none of us could.
Yeah, why think is about that? Why even? Because
it's too heavy. Only because it's too heavy to take down.
Why is that in there?
I mean, you know, and coming in now a time when we have, you know, countries toppling dictatorships, and we've got, you know, Jerry Sandusky and all of these things. And these are statues that are, by howdy, these are villains, and we are taking their statues down. And it's these kids being like, eh, we thought about it, but we're pretty busy. Like, they're just not. It's so, because there's, the stakes are so high for them, but really there are basically no stakes at all ever.
Well, they did give...
That you feel really...
Maybe you'd feel better knowing that they did give the statue a whipped cream bikini with very inconvenient straps.
Oh, the straps in my arms.
And Billy Bob attempted to throw liquor at it, but it never made it.
It's still in the air somewhere. So. It's still going.
Oh, well, I'm going to go back to the landing strip.
Carlos, what about you?
Okay, this is the first time I've ever seen it where I feel differently about some of the things that are happening in it, and that's because I'm getting older and more mature. This feels way rapier than when I was a kid and I saw it, and... I remember liking Tweeter, and I did find him kind of repulsive by the end of the film. I did feel worse for John Voight's character, and actually for John Voight by the end of the movie. And like I said, Donna has kind of opened my eyes to the idea that the coach is not quite the villain that he's being made out to be. But I still enjoy this movie. I on a technical standpoint, I think all of the football sequences are really well done. I think that the chemistry between the actors was mm-hmm. there, and you could believe that these guys played football together. And as a fan of the Friday Night Lights TV show, which we've referenced 90 times, a lot of what that show, a lot of the major DNA of that show comes from, obviously, from the book Friday Night Lights and from the film that Peter Berg made, but a lot of it also comes from Varsity Blues. Like the idea that it's the star quarterback who gets injured. Even just the colors that they wear on the show are the same colors that they wear in Varsity Blues. Like there are a lot of things that were not present in the book or the film of Friday Night Lights that are in the show that are from Varsity Blues, that feel very inspired by Varsity Blues. And so I can thank Varsity Blues for that, because Friday Night Lights is one of the best series of all time.
It is. I mean, yeah, if we need Varsity Blues to get to Friday Night Lights, the TV show, then seriously, so be it. If you haven't seen that show, listeners, like, do yourselves a favor. Carlos is not exaggerating. It's an amazing, whether you like football or not, like it's an amazing show.
Yeah.
I did not like this movie, to the surprise of no one, I'm sure. I know. Wouldn't that be crazy? It all wraps up, and I'm like, a fine film. So I think it sidesteps what should be the real conflicts in the story. I think it's trying to make a bunch of different points without actually having a real point of view. And I think it's incredibly sexist. And with something like Once Bitten, the cluelessness becomes charming and entertaining. There's one mean-spirited scene that really stands out in that film, because the rest of it isn't. And the rest of it feels very innocent and very naive. But I thought most of Varsity Blues, or a lot of it, was mean-spirited. And that's why I can't just sit back and enjoy it for like how misguided it is. A lot of it just made me feel gross. And I hate to be a buzzkill. I know a lot of people will hear this and maybe think I need to lighten up or not take it so seriously. And to which I would say, like, I'm not. Like, we're going to wrap this episode and I'll probably never think about this movie again. And if you are able to enjoy the film for what it is, then who am I to tell you not to? You know, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just articulating that, you know, why in this instance I wasn't able to do that, and to maybe give everybody, you know, one or two things to think about the next time they watch it. I always get so nervous when this happens because I start thinking about people who might have a real attachment to this, and I think about how hard a lot of this might be for them to listen to. I don't know. I mean, this one just rubbed me the wrong way. There are bright spots. Like, again, John Voight is great. You guys are right. The chemistry between the players is really good. Like you said, the games that feels authentic. That's shot really well. And mainly, honestly, Carlos, I just want to say thank you for being such a good sport while, you know, Donna and I were not so kind to this. Like, sincerely, thank you for having like a good attitude about all this and for letting us air our grievances. And
I've been crying the whole time.
Oh shit! Mm. Well,
oh no, my friends don't like me. Oh no! But you're welcome. You're welcome, both of you, for this movie.
Yay!
All right, that's it for us. If you haven't already, subscribe on iTunes or through our RSS feed. Like our Facebook page to find out what we're looking at next and to share your own memories of these films. Let us know if you have suggestions for other titles we should revisit, and we'll see you next time.